From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. People in Texas are miserable right now after the entire state was hit by a winter storm that brought snow and frigid temperatures. Millions of people have already gone more than 2 days without power. A lot of people don't have running water, and it's not over. More snow and freezing rain is falling today in parts of southern, central, and eastern Texas. Let's bring in Dominique Walsh. He joins us from San Antonio. He's with Texas Public Radio. And Dominique, some people are going into their third day with no power. Give us a sense of the scope of these outages.
It's still massive. ERCOT, which is the operator of the state grid here in Texas, ERCOT says there's still 2.7 million households without power. And, you know, that's not 2.7 million people. That's 2.7 million households with families, lots of people. We're talking about millions and millions of people who have now gone, you know, 48 hours or more without power.
What are these power companies saying today about when power will be restored and why this storm caused such a massive power failure in Texas?
So as for the second part of that question, the why, it's the same problem that we saw on Sunday. You know, as the snow started to fall and temperatures started to plunge, demand for power, for heating, surged. At that same time, a bunch of power plants were knocked offline by the weather because they were not properly weatherized for a winter storm. So you had surging demand and dropping supply. That's why these rolling blackouts started. Since then, the storm has also taken offline, you know, various pieces of equipment. So you have a mix of, you know, supply and demand driven blackouts, as well as equipment damage driven blackouts. As for when that will be resolved, there has not been a definitive timeline laid out just yet. What ERCOT and other companies are saying is, you know, hold tight. They're working on it. But really, it might not be resolved until the temperatures start to rise, which might be later this week into the weekend. But again, no definitive timeline.
Okay. Dominique, to add to this misery, as I mentioned, there are people in the dark and without running water or with very low water pressure, and there are boil water notices in some areas. What's going on with the water?
Yeah, so the water situation really depends on where you are. I can tell you at my apartment in San Antonio, the pipes have been frozen since, you know, late Sunday. In other parts, power to water treatment plants have been affected. So water treatment plants in some rural areas have been knocked offline. So those areas have either shut down water or have put, you know, boil water notices in place. In other areas like Houston, there's very low water pressure because people have been dripping their faucets. That's affected the water quality. Houston now has a boil notice for its water. But here's the thing about these boil notices. In Texas, a lot of homes rely on electric stoves. If your electricity is out, you can't heat the water. You can't bring it to a boil. So yeah, it's a problem for a lot of people across the state. And even if you do have water and you're supposed to boil it, you might not be able to if you don't have electricity.
Mm-hmm. There's another storm bringing snow and freezing rain today. People in Texas are not used to navigating roads in this kind of weather. And without power, we're hearing that stoplights aren't working. How are the roads right now?
The roads are still terrible. Officials are saying do not drive if you don't have to. You know, I believe tomorrow will mark the 1 week mark of that awful pile up in Fort Worth. More than 100 vehicles, at least 6 people killed in that pile up. Things have gotten worse since then. So the messaging from all the officials is stay off the roads if you can.
Yeah, the weather has also upended food and other supply chains. Are grocery stores and pharmacies and other businesses open?
Some of them are. It depends on where you are, what business it is. Some of them are, but, you know, trucks haven't been able to make, you know, consistent, frequent supply runs. So the supply lines have fallen short. We're seeing a lot of photos and videos of empty, you know, grocery store shelves, you know, Targets, HEBs here in Texas, Walmarts. All of them are starting to run short on supplies. So even if they are open, they might not have everything you need. And because of COVID-19 precautions, there are often long lines outside of the grocery stores, stretching for blocks and blocks, people having to wait hours to get inside to a grocery store that doesn't have everything they need.
Yeah, we know there are warming centers and food pantries open. A lot of these nonprofits are asking for donations. Dominique, you mentioned that your pipes are frozen. How are you doing?
I'm okay. So I actually left my apartment and am with a coworker now who fortunately does have power because they're on the same circuit as critical service. For folks who might not have power or water, though, the thing to do if you are, you know, looking for help is if you're in a city, call 311. If you're in a rural area, call 211. They should be able to give you resources in terms of where to go for warming centers, food pantries, other things like that. There's also lots of mutual aid work going on right now. But even all of these services have been impacted by the weather. So, and also COVID-19 has complicated some of these warming centers. So various cities are starting to open up more resources. And again, 311 for cities, 211 for rural areas to find those resources.
Thank you so much for that reminder. And you stay safe, Dominique. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
That's Texas Public Radio's Dominique Anthony Walsh in San Antonio.
Well, former President Trump could still face legal consequences for the Capitol insurrection despite his recent acquittal by the U.S. Senate. Democratic Representative Benny Thompson of Mississippi has filed a civil lawsuit against him, accusing the former president of conspiring with far-right extremists that stormed the Capitol last month. Here's Thompson on CNN last night.
I'm convinced that he acted irresponsibly. We're bringing this action. I look forward to having my day in court.
Emily Bazelon has been following this and other legal problems pending against Trump. She's a senior research scholar at Yale Law School and a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
So Congressman Thompson is invoking something called the Ku Klux Klan Act, alleging that Trump conspired to interfere in Congress's certification of the Electoral College count. What's his argument?
His argument is that President Trump made specific threats. This is what that he would have to show to win, the congressman, including actions that threaten the right to vote and prevent federal officers from doing their job. So this is a law that was passed in the 1870s when there was a lot of concern about the Ku Klux Klan threatening black people, terrorizing them, and terrorizing members of Congress in a way that threatened the right to vote. And so the idea is to take that law and apply it to Trump's role in the assault on the Capitol on January 6th.
Has that law ever been used in modern times?
It's been used rarely. Not because it couldn't apply, but because the Supreme Court in the 1870s and 80s was pretty hostile to it and blocked a lot of claims by black litigants. And so it kind of fell out of favor. Recently, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and a couple of other groups have tried to kind of resuscitate it. And so that's what you're seeing here is this idea that this historical law could be relevant in modern times, given these very particular facts.
Well, this is interesting. Trump was acquitted by the Senate in his impeachment trial, of course, and it was considering some of these same questions. But, of course, what Thompson is doing here is a civil lawsuit. So what kind of legal hurdles does he have to clear in order to win?
So he has to show that there were specific threats made that would prevent federal officers from doing their jobs. That was the thing that Congress was concerned about in the 1870s, was the idea that there were members of the KKK who were preventing the federal government from ensuring the right to vote. And that was a particular context in, you know, our tortured history about race in this country. And then the question is whether Trump's remarks and encouraging of the Capitol assault and refusal to stop it really is applicable here, because it was also a kind of threat that didn't let federal officers address the right to vote.
Yeah, well, this, of course, not the only lawsuit the former president is facing. He's also under investigation by the Attorney General of New York and the District Attorney of New York. Those cases touch mostly on his business dealings. What kind of threat do they pose for Trump?
I mean, the most basic way to think about this is that it's an inquiry into tax fraud. And this question of whether Trump and the Trump Organization have inflated the value of assets they own to get favorable loan rates and to get tax write-offs, and whether this could even verge into criminal activity. So that's what both the New York Attorney General and the Manhattan DA's office are investigating.
There's also what's going on with Georgia. Prosecutors there investigating Trump's attempts to overturn the state's election and that phone call that he made to the Secretary of State. What are the range? You know, we've talked about a couple of cases here. What are the range of consequences that the former president might be facing?
Well, in some ways, the Georgia inquiry is the most serious because this could lead to criminal charges against former President Trump. The district attorney in Georgia is investigating whether the facts of that call to the Secretary of State that encouraged him to, you know, quote, find votes that would presumably flip the election, whether that is criminal solicitation to commit election fraud. We usually give public officials some pretty broad range in being able to challenge election results because we want to make sure that those results hold up. But if Trump was doing something that was actually pushing election officials to change the results fraudulently, and if he knew that was what he was asking, that could be fraud.
Yeah. Emily Bazelon, senior research scholar at Yale Law School and staff writer at The New York Times Magazine. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
President Biden is back in Washington today, where he's pushing to get his economic recovery package through Congress. And just last night, in Milwaukee, at the first town hall of his presidency, he made some bold promises about vaccines and schools reopening. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson joins us now. And Mara, let's hear what Biden said at the CNN town hall last night when he was asked about vaccines.
When we came into office, there was only 50 million doses that are available. We have now, by the end of July, we'll have over 600 million doses, enough to vaccinate every single American.
It's a big promise. Is he on track to get that done?
Well, he's on track to hit it if a lot of other things fall into place. If the supply keeps up, if he finds enough what he calls vaccinators, people who can actually administer the shots. And the White House put out a vaccination progress chart today with a 7-day average of daily doses, and they're going up. They started January 13th, less than a million doses of vaccines a day administered. Now, February 10th through 16th, 1.7 million a day. If it keeps on going in that rate, yes, he'll meet his target.
All right. Well, we're going to keep a close eye on those numbers. Meanwhile, on the issue of education, the White House has had some miscommunication recently about schools reopening. But last night, Biden said that his goal was to open the majority of K through 8 schools in the next 100 days. That is different, Mara, than what we've heard from his press secretary last
week.
That's
right. He corrected that. His press secretary had set a remarkably low bar of what he meant by school opening. She said that it meant having half of them having in-person instruction one day a week by the end of the first 100 days. Last night in that town meeting, Biden said that was a mistaken communication. He wants to see K through 8 classes back 5 days a week. And it's important that he do this because school openings is becoming a huge political issue. Republicans are saying the Biden administration isn't aggressive enough to get kids back into school, that they're kowtowing to the teachers' unions. Opening schools to many Americans is the single most important signal of getting back to normal, in addition to the many, many reasons why it's so important for kids and parents to get schools open again. So this has become a political issue, and the president wanted to correct the record last night.
Yeah, and this was his first big appearance in public after the impeachment trial. He likes these kind of events. Hasn't gotten to do them very much because of the pandemic. How did he do in the spotlight, would you think?
I thought he did fine. He was all the things that Biden is. He was empathetic. He seemed to know his brief. He also was very loquacious and also kind of boring. He went on and on at times. But he didn't make any big gaffes, which is always the concern about Biden as a political performer. But this is a format that he likes. He likes to engage with people. Many times he said to questioners, could you stay after and I'll see if I can help you. We'll give you some more information. So I think he did fine.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
What you're hearing is a selection off of Luca Yopanqui's debut album, and it was created by her parents before Luca was even born. Luca's parents are Elizabeth Hart, the bassist from the band Psychedelic Ills, and producer Ivan Diaz-Mate. They used synthesizers and biosonic devices to record and translate the sounds of Elizabeth's womb. And Elizabeth and Ivan join us now. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Thank you.
I think every new parent, when they first hear those sounds of that first ultrasound, feel like this is music to my ears. But you all actually took this one step further. Take us to that first decision to turn the sounds of Luca into an album, Elizabeth.
Well, Evie had been working a lot with this biosonic MIDI device with recording plant music. So as I had progressed in my pregnancy, we recorded this album when I was in the last trimester, so 8 months, seven and eight months. We wondered what it would be like to try this technology on me.
Yes. And so, Ivan, you've been playing around with this. Let's talk a little bit more about this technology. As Elizabeth said, it's called a MIDI. It's a device connected to Elizabeth's stomach that fed data into synthesizers that were at your hands. Can you describe more about how this works and actually how long this process was, Ivan?
Yeah, I think the simplest example that is accessible to everybody is the polygraph. You have electrodes connected that measure or receive your electromagnetic impulses and the changes in that current that every living being has.
Yes.
People have developed a technology from which these same electromagnetic impulses are translated into MIDI notation. For people that don't know what MIDI is a musical language that carries or contains the information of what notes in what position for how long. That's the information that we received from Elizabeth's and Luca's bodies combined. That is translated into this score. It's like if they were the musicians choosing what to play. And the synthesizers are the sounds that I choose to apply to that information that is being picked up.
This took quite a while, right? Each session took about 5 hours.
The first session was kind of like dipping our feet in the ocean, trying to understand what we could get from this experiment. Both Elizabeth and I would be in the studio, and she would sit in front of the speakers, and we would blast the music like pretty loud because we wanted her to be immersed in this music that she also was producing in real time, you know, to be influenced by what you are producing is very interesting.
This is so interesting because what you're saying here is you also were trying to keep the integrity of Luca's musical autonomy, as you put it, specifically as you describe, a way to allow her message to exist in its raw form. Let's listen to this song on the album called V4.3 Part 2. You know, Elizabeth and Ivan, what's so powerful and wonderful about music is that the interpretation of it is in the hearts and the minds of the listener. And a lot of times that's separate from the original intent of the artist. But what you're saying here is this is Luca's message. So I want to know from both of you, what messages do you hear when you listen to this song? I'll start with you, Elizabeth.
Well, I think for me, it was just sort of, you know, you wonder things, especially as it gets closer to the time when you're going to meet your child, of what are they thinking? Because when I was pregnant, I kept feeling like she was really quirky or something. I don't know. Things would make me laugh. The thing about this technology and this thing is that it's actually not intellectual music. Mm-hmm. You know, these sounds aren't chosen. Like, I would choose to write something on bass or guitar or other things. It's just what's created by the impulses. And so to me, that's, I don't think it's a direct message, but it's an interesting way of thinking about it, you know?
It is. I mean, for you, Ivan, are you thinking in this way too, right? It's not intellectual music, but as Elizabeth said, you know, she was trying to think about the personality of her child. Any person who's been pregnant before knows they're making a lot of movements in there. And once you can actually hear that on an audio level, it kind of changes the dynamic and what you're actually hearing. What do you hear when you listen to Luca's music?
For me, the most beautiful or outstanding part of the project is, as Elizabeth was saying, that there's no intention behind. When we play music, there's an intentionality, there's feelings that we want to convey with this. It's like autopilot, you know, you withdraw the driver and suddenly you're going places that you wouldn't have gone yourself, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it, for me as an engineer, it was a beautiful, it's like if you were a cook and they bring you this great ingredient, you know?
A cool experience for sure. Let's hear another song. Elizabeth, Luca is 15 months old right now. And so now yes. You actually know her personality very well. And there's no guessing. Mm-hmm. Has she heard the album? Has she responded in the way that only a 15-month-old can at this point, if she actually has heard it?
Well, she has, because when we were mixing the album, she was always there. So she was exposed to it a lot during the mixing process. And she did seem to recognize the music. Like one time we had something else playing and then switched to this music, and she kind of looked at both of us like, I know what that is or something, I don't know.
Yeah, I thought this mix was done.
Well, how should listeners approach this album?
I think this was like going into a lab without having any chemical background, you know. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, let's play in this playground of sounds. Let's see what we can do with this new way of generating music, of writing music. It certainly took us through a totally new journey.
Well, thank you for allowing us to be on your journey through this album. That was Elizabeth Hart and Ivan Diaz Mate on the album Sounds of the Unborn, created using the sounds of their daughter while she was in the womb. Luca's album will officially be released in April. Elizabeth and Ivan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
Decades before the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, Marcus Garvey attracted millions of followers with a message of Black self-sufficiency and Black nationalism in Africa.
For our Black History Month special series, The Seismic Influence and Complicated Legacy of Marcus Garvey.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
President Biden is meeting with labor union leaders at the White House today. On the agenda, infrastructure and green jobs. The meeting follows a new report from a former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development that could inform Biden's long-term infrastructure plans. Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan has more on this story. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Peter.
Hey, so what do unions want on infrastructure from the White House, and what do we know so far about President Biden's plans?
Well, what unions always want is jobs. Good jobs. And President Biden wants to invest a lot in infrastructure, particularly clean energy, clean transportation projects. He's argued that that can go hand in hand with jobs. He started off on kind of a bad foot with labor unions because one green initiative was to immediately cancel the Keystone Pipeline. First day on the job for him, and that resulted in layoffs. So now he's back to showing them, look, he wants to spend trillions of dollars and that's going to create a whole lot more jobs in his view than the Keystone cancellation cost.
Yeah, he's probably learning very quickly that there are competing interests on every issue, right?
That's
so
for sure.
There's a new report from the former HUD Secretary Henry Cisneros and the Kinder Institute for Urban Research that may be guiding some of his thinking here on infrastructure. It identified about 1,800 projects that Biden should focus on. Let's tick through. I mean, we're not going to tick through all of them, but let's tick through at least what you think the priorities look like they could be.
Right. Well, they said there are three big categories. They said essential infrastructure after the pandemic – climate resilience, and urban-rural connections. And one thing I thought was interesting, there was one thing in particular that showed up in two of those three categories, and that's broadband. And Peter, as you know, for a lot of us, we can joke now about the dial-up internet days, but for a lot of Americans, in rural America especially, those days are still here. They still don't have fast internet, and that is now essential infrastructure. And the report makes that point, that infrastructure isn't just what we picture traditionally as infrastructure, you know, a bridge, for example, but something like broadband, which still lacks in a lot of America, would require some public investment to get there, because the problem there is that it's just so expensive to do that the companies that provide a lot of us with fast internet service aren't willing to do it on commercial terms in rural America.
What are some of the big ideas for transportation? You are our transportation analyst, after all.
Yeah, well, you know, there too, clean transportation. So that means electric vehicles, first of all. We've seen a big movement recently in terms of the big automakers really embracing and acknowledging that that's the future. But there too, sort of a gap in terms of an opportunity perhaps for public incentives to get that going. And that, of course, could create jobs as well. And then when it comes to energy, you know, a focus this week, this report was a long-term project, not prepared with what's going on in Texas and elsewhere in right. mind. But we see now all kinds of needs in that regard too. And alternative energy could perhaps diversify the energy supply and help when a situation like this comes up in the future.
Yeah, this is all great. In theory, it'll be tough potentially to get any of these things through Congress, but we'll see. Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Peter.
The state of Georgia is looking to overhaul its citizens' arrest statute. It's a statute that was used to defend the three white men that chased and shot Ahmaud Arbery, a black man last summer, who was out jogging. The ability to arrest a citizen dates back to the Civil War, and it allows citizens to detain someone if a crime is committed in their presence or with their knowledge. There is no evidence that Arbery had committed any crime. Emma Hurt from member station WABE in Atlanta has been following the efforts to change the law, and she joins us now. Emma, welcome.
Hi, Tanya.
Hi. So a group of mostly Democratic lawmakers began advocating for the repeal of this statute back in May. How would this proposal, which is spearheaded, by the way, by the Republican governor, change the ability for a citizen to arrest someone?
Yeah, so right now, as you mentioned, the statute is really vague. It allows anybody, if you witness a crime, to arrest somebody else. It doesn't say anything, I should add, about killing someone, which is what happened to Ahmaud Arbery, as we know. And this new plan would repeal that statute and replace it with one that just allows really specific kinds of citizen detainment, as they're calling it, like a shop owner who witnesses a shoplifter. And it also explicitly prohibits any use of force except in self-defense.
Okay. As I mentioned, this dates back to 1863. And this law was established during really one of the worst periods of racial tension in our history. And it's remained unchanged, as you said. What was the original intent behind it?
Yeah, so provisions like this really date back to medieval times. Kind of the idea is when police couldn't arrive on time or law enforcement wasn't around, citizens had to take things into their own hands. And the Georgia law, as you said, dates back to 1863 and the state's original code, which was drafted by a secessionist. But we don't know exactly, while we don't know what the exact intent was, we know that Georgia leaders have decided that it really leaves too much room for what they're calling vigilantism. So people taking the law into their own hands. That's what the men who are in jail for Arbery's murder say they were trying to do, even though there's been no evidence that he committed the burglary they accused him of. And it's also why Arbery's death has been called a modern day lynching, because this really does evoke so much of what we saw in the South, especially in decades past.
What's the next step in this process of overhauling the statute?
this has a really good chance of passing. It's got the governor's support, other of the state's top Republican officials, and Democratic leaders in the legislature as well, who've been calling for this since May. And, you know, if it passes any indication, there was a similar push to pass Georgia's hate crimes law in the summer after Arbery's death, and that sailed on through. So we're expecting this to move pretty quickly and smoothly. This is really a second promise that lawmakers made to the Brunswick community, along with citizens' arrest after the outrage.
That's Emma Hurt with member station WABE in Atlanta. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Tanya.
The Republican senators who voted to convict former President Trump continue to face backlash from their own party. Republican Senators Bill Cassidy of Louisiana and Richard Burr of North Carolina are the latest to be censured by their state parties. The chairman of the North Carolina Republican Party, Michael Whatley, explained his decision today on Morning Edition.
You know, as a member of the Senate, you have the absolute right to vote your conscience, how you feel. But at the same time, we felt that it was important to put out a statement saying that we disagreed with those actions.
Let's get another perspective from Douglas High. He used to work for Senator Burr. He's also a former spokesman for the Republican National Committee. He's on Skype. Douglas, welcome.
Thank you.
And what kind of statement do you think the North Carolina Republicans made by censuring Senator Burr?
Ultimately, a dumb one. I've known Michael Whatley for a long time. I like Michael. But if you look at the statements that he's made, he's tried to bend over backwards to say, we still like Richard Burr. He can make his vote of conscience, but we had to make a decision here. He knows this is the wrong thing to do. And hundreds of state activists doesn't represent the broad swath of voters. And let's remember, Richard Burr wasn't elected to represent Republicans. He was elected to represent the entire state. And then meanwhile, since the election, in North Carolina alone, more than 15,000 Republicans have left the Republican Party and have registered unaffiliated. If I want to elect more Republicans in North Carolina, I don't spend my time fighting one of our own who's been there for 20 years fighting for North Carolina. I try and register more voters and look to why voters are leaving my party.
You say he knows it was the wrong choice, but this vote was unanimous. I mean, there was no dissent at all, even in the decision to censure this senator. So does he really know?
Yes. I saw him on CNN with John Berman, you know, yesterday, where again he bent over backwards to say Richard Burr is still a good senator. You know, having worked for Richard Burr, I know that he focuses on doing the right thing first and doing the politically expedient thing second.
So what's going on? I mean, what are the conditions like out there that are forcing these Republican Party members to do this?
Well, it's a loyalty to Donald Trump first and foremost, and some of that is fundraising. Some of that is wanting to be a part of that team, even though it's a team that, again, is hemorrhaging voters in state parties throughout the country. What they're doing, unfortunately, means that as the party gets smaller, it gets Trumpier. So they're listening to those loud and angry voices even more. But county chairs and state chairs are not voters.
As you know, this is not just happening in North Carolina. We've seen censure votes since the election, really, in places like Louisiana, Arizona, Wyoming. In Pennsylvania, Republicans are considering censuring Senator Pat Toomey, who voted to convict Trump. And here's a county Republican chair. His name is Dave Ball, talking about Toomey's vote on KDKA-TV in Pittsburgh.
We did not send him there to vote his conscience. We did not send him there to do the right thing or whatever he said he was doing. We sent him there to represent us.
Did you ever think that you would hear something like that from someone in the Republican Party?
Absolutely, because I already have. I remember in 2014, when I worked in the House of Representatives, Republicans were pushing a series of bills that we called Making Life Work to deal with things like employment training and flex time for working parents. And a Republican member on the floor said to another, why are we doing all these things to help people? And so it's not a surprise to me, because Donald Trump is as much a symptom as he is the cause of where Republicans are. This predated Donald Trump. It will outlive Donald Trump. But the reality is, for that county chair, Pat Toomey, I can't speak for Pat Toomey, but he wasn't elected to serve a particular county party. He was elected to serve all of Pennsylvania. And let's not forget that Joe Biden won Pennsylvania.
Right. You know, I'm looking at what happened in Utah. I'm sure you saw that Senator Mike Lee voted to acquit the former president. Senator Mitt Romney voted to convict. And the state party, as Republicans were talking about censuring Romney, the state party released a statement this week that said, the differences between our own Utah Republicans showcase a diversity of thought in contrast to the danger of a party fixated on unanimity of thought. What do you think about that statement? And what's going on in Utah that they're taking a different approach?
It's refreshing to hear something like that. Part of that, though, is Donald Trump is not popular in Utah. He underperformed there last time. I think Utah Republicans know, proceed at your own peril if you want to, you know, really be a part of Team Trump. It's a dangerous road to be on.
We often see national politics through the lens of Congress, right? But how much power do you think these state and county parties actually have in shifting the dialogue and the direction of politics in this country?
On the local and state level, they have enormous influence. They have an impact on the structure of the Republican National Committee, but it's not moving anything broadly when it comes to voters. You know, in his statement, Michael Whatley talked about, you know, the 100 county chairs, but there are a lot more than 100 Republican voters in the state of North Carolina, just as there are in any state. And those voters aren't focused on the internal machinations of a county or state party. They're looking for issues and results. And as Republicans spend time going after their own, again, especially when they're losing Republican voters, it says that 2022, which historically should be a good year for Republicans, may not be because they're willing to give away voters in the name of Trump.
Douglas High used to work for North Carolina Senator Richard Burr, also a former RNC spokesman. Thank you.
Thank you.
Scientists trying to map the Pacific seafloor got an unexpected assist from the world's second largest mammal. These fin whale songs are usually treated as noise by seismologists because they muddy up data gathered at the bottom of the ocean. But new research published this month in the journal Science found the loud chirps that fin whales make actually have a similar effect as the advanced instruments seismologists use to peer into the Earth's oceanic crust. Václav Kuna is a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute of Geophysics in Prague. This discovery was part of his research at Oregon State University, and he joins me now to talk about it. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Let's hear a little bit more of what these fin whale chirps sound like. These are fin whale calls that have been sped up 10 times so they're audible to the human ear. Tell us about when you realized these sounds might be more than just noise.
It was actually quite a coincidence. I was working with seismicity, and we had these ocean bottom seismic stations on the ocean bottom. And when I was searching through the data and looking on something that was earthquake related, I realized those were fin whales. And because I'm a seismologist, I found out that there might be some signals that are actually not just the water waves that are traveling through the water, but also some subsurface signals.
Give us a sense of how loud these whales are.
So they are very loud. Those are one of the loudest sounds in the ocean. They are about 189 decibels, which is comparable to engines of large ships. So they are very, very loud.
Were you surprised no one else had thought to use whale songs in this way before?
Actually, yeah, I was quite surprised because for me, being a seismologist, this is kind of an obvious use of them. But I suppose that mostly the fin whale calls and other whale vocalizations, they have been studied extensively by biologists and by people who are interested in whales themselves and not that much of seismologists that would be looking at it from a different perspective. So, yeah, I was quite surprised that nobody have thought of this before.
Okay, let's break down your work a little bit. So what exactly are you trying to figure out about the seafloor, and how do you typically go about getting that information?
So in seismology, it's a quite common task that we are trying to display what's underneath the ground, meaning that we are trying to find out what the thickness of crustal layers are and also what's the seismic velocity in those layers. And we need to know these things for many applications, like oil and gas industry uses this information a lot, but also for scientific applications, for geology, climatology, and seismology too. So we always need to have some kind of a source of signal that travels beneath the ground and then bounces off layers in the ground. And then receivers that can receive these signals. And based on the time that the signal travels from the source to the receiver, we can calculate the thickness and the velocities within the crust. And the source is usually something that is called an air gun, which is like a quite large pressurized chamber. But those are also very expensive. And also they create a lot of noise in the ocean that is being debated to be harmful for ocean wildlife.
Oh, that's interesting with the air guns. How do the whale calls compare to the air guns?
They are not as loud as air guns. And also the fin whales, they have quite a narrow frequency range. And the air guns, they are much more broadband. So they go from these low frequencies up to hundreds of hertz. So characteristics of the sound or of the signal definitely favors the air gun. However, the fin whales are just out there already. And we have recorded so many of them. And also, we just don't need to create artificially those signals that may bother the wildlife out there.
Do you think this finding could reduce the use of air guns in the future?
Well, the fin whales cannot definitely replace air guns because they can penetrate deeper and we can get higher resolution of the subsurface. However, using air guns is very expensive and also it's being quite a bit regulated. So I think at some places where we cannot either afford or cannot use air guns for ecological reasons, we may get like some supplement from the fin whale calls and we can use them in a similar manner.
Václav, you're a seismologist benefiting from biology, but could it go the other way too? I mean, fin whales are endangered. Could this research help biologists and conservationists actually protect them?
I think in a way it can. Fin whale calls has been studied on ocean bottom seismic stations previously. So I would not say that my study is the first of its kind in this manner. Studying or using seismological tools to study whales is definitely possible. And we can track whales and we can maybe estimate quantities. And yeah, methods similar to what I showed in the paper can be used and can help biology too.
Václav Kuna is a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute of Geophysics in Prague. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.